The screenplay for Star Trek, the movie, called for the crew of the spaceship Enterprise to encounter a celestial entity no man had ever seen before. Sid Mead was hired to design it. That's a typical assignment for Mead. He imagines the technology and environment of the future and designs it on paper. He drew up the plans for the vehicles, appliances, weapons, and sets for the post-apocalyptic fantasy Blade Runner. He created a world inside a video game for Tron, designed the spaceships in Aliens, and co-created the robot in Short Circuit. His creations aren't limited to the world of fantasy. For NASA, he provided illustrations for the interior of Skylab. He did the same for Air France's Concorde. He's consulted to many automobile manufacturers and has participated in the design of theme parks and entertainment complexes. His work has been exhibited in one-man shows in the United States and Japan. Sid Mead's company is headquartered in Los Angeles. Sid Mead, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I'd like to start with what is perhaps now your best-known set of designs, and that is for the film Blade Runner. And what I'd like you to do, since the look of that movie has become so famous and so imitated, to tell us what you had in mind in the overall image that you were trying to work with.
I was hired by Ridley Scott. Met with him when the movie was still in the very early script stages, and following that script, which was a dramatization of Philip K. Dick's novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which in itself was a sort of a disappointed, dire view of a future. And the idea was to create a background for a story that is very romantic, but at the time it was reviewed by critics as too violent, sort of a off-color, dark, moody kind of film. But we deliberately tried to make the sets, the fixtures, all fit into a sort of a evolved social economic theory that supported the idea of the story, which was that off-world development had sort of sucked dry the available capital for things going nice and pleasant here on Earth. And as in a lot of movie stories, the universe in which the picture takes place or the story takes place is shrunk down just simply so you can handle it as a visual presentation. But we created a style which was literally piling things on top of other things that already existed on the theory that you had to make things work. And we called it sort of humorously retro deco, and that evolved into trash chic.
One of the things that you designed for the movie were flying vehicles. Did you think of them as flying cars?
The vehicles that I was originally hired to design, I later sort of drifted into interior and street sets and the hardware. But the vehicles were characters in themselves, and Ridley had seen a book that had just been published in England of my work called Sentinel. And he liked the mechanical logic, the industrial design look, because I'm an industrial design person. And that's why I got to do the job in the first place. The vehicles had to be characters, they had to be logical, and they had to look mechanically like they would actually work. And the flying car, the spinner, which was, I guess, the star vehicle, I thought had to look the same whether it was flying or on the ground. So the changes in the vehicle itself were minimal as it lifted off the ground and flew, and we invented a wonderful propulsion system to allow it to do that. But it was all fantasy, but very logically constructed to suit itself, to make it look logical in the story.
When you're doing a movie design for something of the future, how much do you have to prove that it might work? What kind of ground rules do you have to follow? Can it be as outlandish as you want, or does it have to fulfill certain principles?
Well, it can be as outlandish as you think the audience is going to accept for that story. It's actually, for me, being an industrial design, I think it's easier to actually work for a corporation and design a brand new product. They spend millions and millions and millions of dollars in our research and development. Their laboratories say we can go with this now. Product development approves it. And you design something completely new, maybe a camera or a stove or whatever it happens to be. And you sell the public, you train the public to accept that new idea as a radio or as a TV or something. In a movie, you don't have time to do that. You've got to illustrate literally the script. And working in conjunction with the director and the art director and the production designer, I try to be those people's sort of second educated guess, and you must construct something that looks like the audience expects it to look like in that story and still be new and inventive. So what you're doing is trying to do the most difficult thing possible, is to reinvent a cliché.
So you can't go too far afield because it won't be believable to us.
That's true. You interrupt the story. You can have a story about some fantastic new thing, but that then becomes part of the story itself. It doesn't help the story.
What's the testing process like? Say, for instance, for Blade Runner, for the flying cars. I mean, you can make anything fly with the kinds of special effects that they have in Hollywood, but what kind of testing did you go through to see if this was going to look right and if it would work right for the purposes of the movie?
Well, for the spinner in Blade Runner, the flying car, there is an aerodynamic principle called an aerodyne, which is enclosed lift. The British Harrier jets use this principle. So you can generate lift internally and lift a mechanical object off the ground, as obviated by the fact that the Harrier flies and hovers, takes an awful lot of fuel. I use that principle generally and pretended we had vast amounts of airflow and turbines to make a car-sized object fly with no external means of propulsion.
Now, you've designed... So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it was marginally factual, but that's what you have to do when you create fantasy. You try for about an 80% guess, and the rest is open to everybody's interpretation.
You designed the interior of the spaceship for the movie 2010, and you also did some designs for the interior of NASA's Skylab. And I'd like for you to compare the experience of designing the interior of a spaceship for a movie and one for real life.
Well, Raymond Loewy's studio in New York at the time was working with NASA on the Skylab project, having seen the actual artifact in duplicate of it in Texas. The idea was to make artificial horizons and make people think they weren't really floating around in the middle of no place. So that was a psychological color studies, places for people to grab on for NASA. For the Leonov in 2010, Peter Himes, who directed the film, wanted to definitely have a feeling of mechanical possibility, because now the public has seen pictures of the interior of the shuttle, which isn't very pretty. It's almost as crude as a World War II bomber cockpit. They've seen that. They've seen live shots from space, from the moon. And so people in their heads know that you can go out into space with sort of a packed-together, junky-looking assembly of machinery. And that's exactly what we aimed for, to make it look totally believable.
That's interesting, you know, a futuristic thing looking junky instead of clean and perfect, which was what a lot of movies used to do with the future, I think.
Well, 2001 was, I call it the GE Kitchen of Tomorrow look. The Leonov in 2010, in reality, was almost a retrograde of technology, but dramatically it looked very interesting.
Okay, one other movie I'm going to ask you about, and that is Short Circuit 1 and 2. You co-designed the robot for those movies. There's been so many robots in movies and in science fiction stories. What did you want this robot to do differently?
Well, John Badham was the director of Short Circuit, the first movie, and one of his primary requirements was that the robot had to look like there was nobody inside operating it. That was a primary visual characteristic that he wanted to get across. That's why the robot is very spindly, has a very thin trunk which elevates up and down, and is manipulated very wonderfully by a complicated series of harnesses and remote controls. But that job of designing a major character, and the number five, of course, was a major character, was one of the more difficult things that I've done for feature films.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the place of robots will be in our future?
Well, people have a mental image of what a robot is. You're a dishwasher if you have a machine that does different cycles and picks up the cycle after three segments and so forth. A lot of our very common home devices are, in fact, robots, because a robot is something that does a series of tasks unsupervised and hopefully well enough so that it's worth the time and trouble to keep it maintained and operating. Robots work in factories. They don't look like people. They don't have eyes and ears. They might have a television camera for somebody back in the control room to check on what they're doing. But robots will become more and more part of our life, and they won't look like what we think robots should look like. They'll be buried behind walls, inside of other kinds of looking machines or things.
They won't be modeled to look like us.
Not necessarily. I think that's a cute kind of dramatic idea, but it doesn't really necessarily make a good robot.
My guest is designer Sid Mead, and he designs fantasy future things for movies, as well as designing products and consulting for corporations around the world. I came of age during the World's Fair. Was it 1964? Was it 1964? I think so.
Yes.
All the corporations had their own pavilions, and they were telling you about the world of the future and their products of the future. There was the GE kitchen.
Tomorrow.
The kitchen of tomorrow. And then Ford, I think, was talking about their cars of tomorrow.
Right.
And I feel constantly disappointed. Like they really let me down. You know, the cars, I don't know, they don't seem to last as long in a lot of ways. The highways are all under construction. There's more potholes than ever. Planes look like rundown buses now inside. They seem to really be in a state of deterioration. And as one of the visual futurists, I wonder if you feel disappointed sometimes as well.
Well, yes, I do. I mean, you can't go through life totally first class, isolated from reality. I don't know what they call you when you do that, but either very expensive or on the way to somewhere. I worked on the Ford Pavilion, as a matter of fact.
Oh, did you really?
Fair. I did the found out after I came up with this fabulous design that everybody liked, they cut the budget in half, which was not too kind. But those future projections at that point in time, in particular in the 60s, technology was going to do all these wonderful things. Well, it has, but there's something that happens that I like to call the fiberglass Corinthian column effect. You can buy fiberglass Corinthian columns today and put them up in front of your house. They don't rot. They don't deteriorate. But what we're doing is taking very, very old ideas or accepted cliches, and you change them into new materials, new methodologies. People stay pretty much the same, their attitudes, the way they react with other people. And I think that's important. What technology should do is do the background work and allow people to be more like people, which is random, sort of nutty at times. Hopefully you know you're being nutty, because that means that you're still rational. If you no longer have that grasp, then you're in trouble. But I believe definitely the technology makes our lives better. It also makes life riskier, because you can't take chances without endangering your status quo.
Now, yet the futurist-type landscape that you're best known for, Blade Runner, had really a very bleak view of the future. Do you buy into that view at all?
That was a professional job, and I helped Ridley visualize a film that was as dreary as possible. My own view is much more optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
We have more people working on problems today than ever before, in terms of just raw intelligence. We have enormous capacities, excuse me, in terms of computer-assisted decision-making. And although that isn't its own total answer, it certainly gives us an enormous volume of things to consider before we say yes or no.
I'd like to know how you think about the future when you're asked to design something. For instance, the Los Angeles Times Sunday Magazine asked you for a piece that they were doing on the future to design a car the way it might look in the year 2013. Well, what are you going to? What did you think about to sit down and design that? What kinds of images did you think about? How do you project that far ahead?
Well, you go on the basis of how things are made, because all the objects we ride in, handle, use are made somewhere along the line. Then you match that to how it's going to be used. Are people going to use it, or is it part of a machine, or is it part of a building or architecture? And then you throw in a little bit of sort of nutty, random whimsy, because that's the people part. And I always do definitely give that edge to things, because that's how they're going to turn out. They're going to be some screwball thing on the edge of some neat, clean gizmo that makes it fun to want or fun to have.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the future and your designs for the future. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is designer Sid Mead, and he's created futuristic landscapes and technology for the films Blade Runner, Star Trek, 2010, Tron, and Aliens. He also co-designed the robot for the Short Circuit films, and he's designed many consumer appliances, consulted for many car companies, designed theme parks. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Designer Sid Mead is my guest. I want to stick with cars for just a minute more. We're talking about a car that you projected as existing in the year 2013. Now, you consult with a lot of car companies, or you have in the recent past.
Yes.
What kind of car do you think we're capable of creating now that we're just not creating for whatever reason?
Well, the interesting thing about transportation, which is going from point A to point B, is that more and more of the world's population are congregating in ever larger and larger metropolitan areas. As a trend, you're having architectural complexes get larger and larger also, mainly for convenience. Very juice, high-rises, mega buildings that have towers and condominiums and retail shops and so forth. Architecture solved transportation a long time ago. With elevators was the first big push. The next were speedwalks, speed ramps, escalators. So once you get rid of your car, as you enter a very large architectural complex, you can get around and you just assume that that ability is yours to share because you're there. The vehicle itself, the car, is an extension of the horse-drawn carriage, and the attachment to the car is so visceral and so powerful because you're under your own control until the wonderful thing breaks down, and you put your foot to the floor and it goes immediately. It's the same visceral response that you get riding a horse, and it's a very strong emotional bind. The mass transit system of choice worldwide, for a lot of reasons, is the private type automobile, much to the dismay of city planners and environmentalists. But it offers random travel. You don't have to have money in your pocket to climb in and go. And you have a sort of private little capsule where you can sit there, listen to your own music, do whatever you want, pretty much, in a private mobile container. And that's a very, very difficult thing to compete against in a larger transportation idea.
But do you think that there are interesting, better-built cars that we could have today?
Well, you'd have to blend
instance,
them
for instance, my car dents really easily. I find it hard to believe that there isn't a better structure for the body of my car that would also wouldn't rust as quickly as it does. Image-wise, it could probably, be a lot livelier looking than mine is. But, I mean, what do you think we're capable of having today that...
Well, it's a crossover of cost.
Forget about the future for a second, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, the Fiero, which General Motors produced for years, has been discontinued, had essentially a plastic body, very dent, bump-resistant. The color went all the way through. Really a very advanced material idea to put a plastic outside over a frame inside. It was discontinued not for technological reasons particularly, but just for economic reasons. It wasn't selling well. And it would have taken a lot of money, to re-engineer it to make it competitive. The cars we have today, in terms of being able to control them and the accident rate versus the sort of inattention that most people exhibit when they're driving, I think is quite amazing that they are as good as they are for the price crossover and how long they last for the way they're used. But, of course, the future, I think, will depend on probably more specialty vehicles, people using the vehicles for what they... Or the vehicles being designed for what people use them for, which may not be so much for commuting, but for just getting a kick out of life. And that's a very different demand than having to be sort of a mini computer module to be used every day, shut off, and then start it up again at the end of the day. That's very, very difficult on a vehicle.
Is there an example of something you've designed for a movie that you had to redesign because it didn't quite look right when it was shot?
Well, for 2010, because we were... presumably 9 years later than 2001, I thought, well, by this time we'll have this fantastic ion power propulsion system. And I envisioned this great, beautiful envelope unfolding about 3 football fields in diameter behind the Leonov as we pushed off for Jupiter. And Peter Himes, the director, needed a very dramatic moment at the end of the movie when they're escaping from the imploding planet. And what's more dramatic than 24 rockets being ignited all at once? So we went to rocket power. And it's a very simple, very direct decision. It has to be dramatic.
We were talking before about images of the future and World's Fair projections about what the future was going to be like. I wonder if you have any favorite past images of the future, images of the future from the 50s or 60s that have really stuck in your mind?
Well, one of my favorite cars of all time is the last year of the 50s, the 59 Cadillac Coupe de Ville, which is every man's starship. It was probably one of the most exotic vehicles built in modern times, certainly for mass production. That era, I think a lot of things happened. People suddenly realized that the machines are not magic. If you educate your public to appreciate what has to actually be done to make things work and so forth, you have a public that is a mixture of technical people that appreciate what's going on, then it becomes less magic and you realize that they're utility devices. They're not magic at all. I think that's partly what happened. And as we go into the future, you have more and more people that are knowledgeable about operating and tinkering with computers. One of the nicest things that's happened with the computer revolution is that there are a lot of people who like to play with these things, and they do understand them very, very well. The fears were that we'd have a closed-off whole world of information shifting. Actually, what's happened is that you have a lot of people that are fully capable of countering anything that the government or security or credit companies or whatever might do to try to mess around with your life. They're very capable of countering in kind, which I think is a very encouraging trend.
You've designed a lot of fantasy cars and appliances, technology. I wonder if anything you've designed for a fantasy film has had applications to real life.
I can't think of any instance in my own life, but in my own professional overview, but if you think of the Wrist TV of the Dick Tracy cartoon strip, you can buy a Wrist TV today. So that came true. And it was pure wild science fiction, 20 years ago.
Now, in spite of all the big projects that you've undertaken, you've also designed little simple things like razors.
I worked with Philips to design the, not the current, but the last generation of Philips, the men's shaver. And it was deliberately done to look slick when you at point of sale on the counter. It was ergonomically designed so that it would fit in either hand, of course, had a nice feel to it, but it looked really neat. It wasn't a little miniature block of hard, cold stuff. It was sort of something you held in your hand every morning, and it was designed to be a friendly geometric shape. I've just recently, on the market in Japan, is a machine called a hot water maker. They're eating habits and making tea and miso soup and so forth. They use a lot of hot water in their culture. And the product has been successful. And I've just designed the second generation of that particular product. So that's a long way from doing movie design. But it's every bit as satisfying in both cases, movies and products. You're depending on a large public acceptance. And you absolutely can't predict that. If it happens in your favor, you're very, very fortunate.
It was something like the razor. What you were doing was making it look good, right? Making it look sleek and modern.
I was castigated by the hardcore, I call them Bauhausers. We're sort of getting away from that now. But they said, well, why does it look that way? And I said, because it looks very, very nice. And it's still, you can hold it in your hand. It's not like a drill press where you work at it for 8 hours a day. You hold it for maybe a couple of minutes per day. So you don't have to carefully measure all your pressure points and make sure that your hand isn't tired after 2 hours of holding it, because it isn't that kind of a thing. So you can carry the real meticulous design process a little bit too far.
What's the most bizarre thing you've been asked to design?
Well, I think bizarre in terms of just really something very different. I was given about 3 weeks to think up a $1 billion capitalized theme park in Japan, which has sort of degraded into something much else. That was bizarre just from the scale of expenditure. In terms of serious design, probably the interiors of private 747s. Most people just can't imagine that, because the plane costs $90 million just to begin with, then you spend another $100 million decorating it. That is, I think, bizarre on almost every scale of comparison.
So that's typical of something that you would do you'd be commissioned to design the interior of a private jet.
Yes. And they can get very bizarre in terms of expenditure. and the exotic mixture of engineering and just pure visual arrangement.
Now, the things that you live with in your own home, are they, quote, futuristic, or do you have the same kind of appliances that we all do?
Oh, no, same kind. I use my own water maker that I design. That's sort of a kick. And the house that I have in Hollywood is was built in 1910. It's been all replumbed, rewired, like most people do. But it's an old house. My dream house would be to buy a water tank from, I think, a company called Chicago Bridge and Iron. It's like a big, giant golf ball on a tee. You've seen them. And I think that would make a terrific house. Just cut the top off for a sun deck, elevators inside and a moat, and no door-to-door solicitation, and you'd be splendidly alone at about treetop level.
You know, how much of our past do you think will be in our future? I mean, I live in a really old house myself, and, you know, it's we're past 1984 now, right?
Which
is one of the landmarks of what the future was going to be.
Right.
And the stuff all around us is really, you know, quite old. The architecture, some of the cars, the train systems.
Well, I was invited to be a part of the Fanta Festival in Rome last year, horror and science fiction film festival. Had a one-man show there. Went to a party, a very lavish party, in the house of the Italian director of radio and television. This house has been continuously occupied since the 1450s when it was built. It still has the very shallow steps, well, the low-rise steps for the armored house guards to climb up and down without having to bend their legs too much. He has a VCR projector in the living room. The house is completely air-conditioned. Dimmer switches all set for the computer and all these kinds of electronic and technological updates in this ancient, ancient building. And I like that. I think that's exotic. And I think the future should definitely include that kind of human environment niceties and let the technology just make it more enjoyable.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Terry.
My guest is Sid Mead, and he's a designer and a futurist. He co-designed the robot that can be seen in Short Circuit 2. He's also currently working on a theme park in Japan. He did designs for the films 2010, Tron, Blade Runner, and Star Trek The Movie. His firm is based in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.